From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are dozens more positive tests for COVID-19 in Michigan. Coming up, we'll have a Washington, D.C. update from Senator Gary Peters.
Right now, the most important thing that we need to do, in addition to making sure families are taken care of, is we have to test. We have to radically expand testing across the country. We have to know who is sick and who is not.
Meanwhile, in Lansing, lawmakers are approving large sums of money to deal with the coronavirus, but policy questions linger.
That we're going to see the implications of this crisis playing out in policymaking and policymaking debates for possibly, probably years to come.
And we'll get an update from the Michigan Radio newsroom about drive-through testing for the new coronavirus.
And the nurse told her not to come in and was honest with her and said the reality of this is that they're rationing tests right now.
Those stories and more, we've got a lot to get to this hour on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As you've heard in the newscast, we've received word that the first Michigan death from the new coronavirus has been confirmed. The man in his 50s had other underlying medical conditions, according to Beaumont Health Chief Nursing Officer Susan Grant. Governor Whitmer has an afternoon press conference planned to address the latest information about the outbreak. Beaumont is just one of the health systems that's been doing its own testing on site. Later this hour, we'll talk about drive-through testing. Michigan Radio reporter Sarah Swick found out who can be tested and who might be getting turned away. We'll have the latest coming up in just a few minutes. But first, legislative business has not exactly been put on hold by the arrival of COVID-19. But Capitol Hill has its own set of health concerns, plus an urgent need to respond to what is now happening in all 50 states. With us now is Senator Gary Peters, Democrat representing Michigan. Senator Peters, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, great to be with you. Thank you.
The bill that the House passed last week will provide free coronavirus testing. It details paid emergency leave, enhance unemployment insurance, strengthen some food security matters, and increase federal funding for Medicaid. It was hung up over paid leave. As we're having this conversation, has that been worked out yet?
I believe it has. We believe that we are there right now. We should have a vote sometime today. Mitch McConnell, Leader McConnell, said that we were going to vote. It's frustrating. As you know, this passed back in the early hours of Saturday. We should have just taken it up immediately. This is something that passed broadly bipartisan way in the House. The White House also signed off on it, said they would sign it. We should have been doing this right from the get-go. In fact, we should have never left over the weekend. It should have been done. But hopefully we will move it forward today. But I think it's important.
I'm sorry to interrupt. What tipped the balance, do you think?
I think the public pressure is like, why is this not moving? People are saying, folks may have some concerns about the bill. And we all have concerns about a bill. No bill that we pass is perfect, but we all know there's going to be another bill. We have to do more. This bill is not the end all. We're going to have a follow-up bill that's going to be much larger, much more comprehensive. And if people have concerns, we can address those concerns in the next bill. But let's get this one done so the American people know that there's food assistance, there's unemployment assistance, paid family leave, and that they can get testing and not be fearful of what it might cost. Because right now, the most important thing that we need to do, in addition to making sure families are taken care of, is we have to test. We have to radically expand testing across the country. We have to know who is sick and who is not. It's absolutely essential for us to get control of this disease. You need to know where the hotspots are. You need to know where you have to basically flood the zone in terms of resources to contain the disease and make sure the hospital systems aren't overrun. And you can only do that with testing and data. We saw that firsthand with South Korea. South Korea has done an amazing job of testing. They test roughly 140,000 people a week now, and they're a much smaller country. If you equated that to us in the United States, that would mean a million Americans are being tested every week. That's what's happening in South Korea. And they're starting to turn it. They're starting to turn the corner.
Senator Peters, the last holdup on the House bill was that Senator Rand Paul had an amendment that he'd added requiring proof of Social Security status for child tax credits and terminating military operations in Afghanistan. Is the Senate still functional if discipline is breaking down that way? I mean, there are Michiganders who now have their kids on their hands for, the next few weeks. There are people in nursing homes who, don't have face-to-face contact with their family members? I mean, what is going on in Washington right now?
Well, yeah, it's unacceptable. He wanted that amendment. Apparently, McConnell is going to let him put it on the floor. We will table it immediately. I can't imagine he will get any votes, perhaps other than himself, and we'll table it, and then we can get to the main bill. But you're right, you get individual folks who want to pursue their agenda. Right now, there should be no other agenda except dealing with this crisis with the virus, making sure we're controlling the underlying disease and taking people care of people's lives who are facing a crisis situation in the days and months ahead.
Millions of Americans who've been furloughed are starting to tap unemployment payments. We've started to see various federal branches like Veterans Affairs, Medical Services, and other military resources get deployed. And now President Trump has sent Congress an emergency $46 billion spending request, I believe, for coronavirus-related funding that would be spent this year. What kind of shape is the U.S. government in to handle the financial constraints of a public health emergency and an economic crisis?
Well, we got to do both. You're right. The president did declare a national emergency. That doesn't quite free up the $46 billion. What you have to do is a major disaster. I think Governor Whitmer is looking at declaring a major disaster to be able to then trigger the additional monies that you refer to. I think that's where we're going to get. So that money will be available to state and local governments through disaster assistance. We're going to have to pass a very large appropriation to deal with what is without question heading towards a serious financial crisis in addition to a public health crisis. Those two go together. And that's why their numbers, we're looking at $750 billion up to $1 trillion going to be spent to try to stop the free fall that we're in right now.
I don't know if this is analogous, but my memory after September 11th is that there was this brief period during which politics was turned upside down and there was some bipartisan consensus about what to do. What do the Senate's priorities need to be during that period?
Well, the priorities need to be twofold. First, you've got to deal with the underlying disease and do everything we can to stop slow the spread of the virus. And we have to work to build a vaccine as quickly as possible, although realistically, that's not going to happen for a year or more, just based on the science and what has to be done. We also need to work on drugs to deal with some of the symptoms, especially the severe symptoms that can impact people who are in hospitals. I talked to an expert yesterday who had some hope that we could see those drugs in 3 months, perhaps. That doesn't cure the disease, but allows us to deal with some of the more severe impacts, which will undoubtedly save lives when that comes forward. But while that's happening, we have to simultaneously deal with this financial crisis where people are suddenly finding that their jobs aren't there. Not everybody can work from home. It's great if you can work from home, but unfortunately, most Americans have to show up to work every day at their place of business in order to get paid. They're finding that disrupted. In many cases, those businesses are shutting down. We have to make sure those families have the resources that they need in order to continue to put the roof over their head and put food on the table. And that has to be an immediate priority right now because most people can't afford to wait when you're living paycheck to paycheck. The time period is pretty short before you find yourself in a financial crisis.
What can the veterans medical system do for the country at a time like this?
Well, the veterans system will also provide, can expand some of the health care. We're going to need hospital beds. We're going to need capacity to deal with folks. I had a long discussion yesterday with the CEO of Tenet Health System, which has DMC and other hospitals in Michigan. You know, they're concerned about their capacity to deal with a surge. Because the thing about, we have to remember about hospitals is that you just can't open up a hospital and have every bed available because they're treating people who have other diseases now and are in car accidents and have other medical emergencies. So there's not a lot of excess beds. They're working to sort of eliminate any kind of ones that are not essential, but still there's a limit to that. So anywhere we can get beds and we have facilities, and that includes the VA, we're going to have to call all of those in order to make sure we're dealing with the severe cases. And I think it's important to reiterate, too, that for listeners, I mean, most cases of COVID-19 are not severe. Most of them are either mild or moderate or really, really bad flu. These are very unpleasant thing to go through, and it may take 10 days to get through it. But there are a significant number of very serious cases, and those are the ones that could overwhelm the hospital system just because of the raw numbers of people who could be infected by this disease that's very easy to transmit, and nobody has any immunity to it.
There have been some concerns raised about what a long-lasting pandemic might mean for the election cycle in November. Obviously, there are going to be some very highly watched elections in the U.S. You yourself are up for re-election. We've already seen some problems in Ohio and Illinois with primaries that were regularly scheduled for this week. Acts of Congress are required if we're going to make changes to the general election schedule. Are there any discussions in D.C. right now about how lawmakers can either calm people's fears or make sure that the election happens as scheduled?
There are conversations going on. In addition to the two priorities that I spoke, those are our main priorities right now. We have to act very quickly on that. But certainly, I think most of us were concerned when a governor can basically say, tomorrow we're not going to have an election. We want to make sure that we're preparing, that we will have an election in November. It's essential for our democracy to get through whatever crisis we're in, to continue to have fair and free elections. So we're looking at possible legislation to have vote by mail, for example. You know, we certainly made a good move in Michigan when we have no reason absentee voting. More and more people can just vote from the comfort of their home and have it mailed to them. They can shelter in place and still vote and send their ballot in. How do we put in those kinds of mechanisms to make sure that everybody in the country is able to do that, that they don't necessarily have to show up at a polling place? I mean, we'll see where we are in November. Hopefully we're in a better place than we are now, but we should be preparing for the worst and preparing that people should all have access to vote by mail.
Senator Peters, thank you for your time.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Gary Peters, Democrat representing the state of Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In a strange way, COVID-19 has provided a sort of pause on some of the thorniest challenges facing Metro Detroit. The city government has been involved in nasty tug-of-war battles with water department customers who cannot pay their bills and property owners whose debt prevents them from catching up on property taxes. All that has come to a screeching halt. With us to discuss are Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Caffer. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, April.
And Kat Stafford. She's been covering Detroit for quite some time. She's a national race and ethnicity writer with the Associated Press at present. Kat Stafford, welcome back.
Thank you.
So Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sabry announced this on Monday. The county is not foreclosing on any more homes in 2020. What was your reaction when you heard this? Kat, do you want to start?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have been advocating for this for quite some time, and Nancy has written a lot of amazing columns on this issue. There's been a lot of effort on the ground from activists, as well as some elected officials who have been asking for the county to figure out a way to put a halt to these foreclosures. And although we have seen this be announced, you know, a lot of people are actually looking toward the future, you know, after this year. What does this mean for me as a homeowner who was at risk of foreclosure? So some people are hoping that this moratorium will provide a window and a chance for them to potentially push for more reform around this issue, you know, once we make it through this crisis.
Nancy Caffer, did you ever think that the issue of foreclosures was going to get resolved in quite this manner?
No, I sure didn't. In fact, I've written a couple of times that they need to not have the auction, that it's harmful. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which is get property into productive reuse and tax generating use, which just, we know, does not happen. A lot of properties are more likely to become blighted and vacant because of being in the auction and the foreclosure process. I said they need to stop, and the defense has always been, we have to have the auction. We have to foreclose because it's the law. So it was really surprising to find that actually they could just stop.
You know, the situation with water shutoffs almost feels more surreal. Activists had been asking health officials for much of last year to declare the shutoffs a public health emergency. And the city and the state declined to intervene on health grounds. And then just weeks later, turn around and say, no, people really need to be able to wash their hands. It's like a complete reversal.
It's so surprising because the What's surprising, rather, is that anyone could ever have said that it wasn't a public health crisis for people to not have water, because maybe it's not coronavirus, maybe it's the regular seasonal flu, maybe it's norovirus, maybe it's any one of the other seasonal, you know, regular, more accustomed illnesses that we all deal with. Those things are always there. And so, you know, it's so maddening that there was not a connection drawn between, oh, this is a public health risk. The crisis isn't coronavirus. The crisis is there are people living long-term or short-term without water and sewage. That's the crisis.
I realize I've been sort of oversimplifying both situations. Detroit Water has instituted a temporary billing that ceilings out at $25 to make it affordable for people to reconnect, with the understanding that they'll still have to pay their outstanding water bills later. And Wayne County has worked out property tax payments.
So, which was not made incredibly clear when they first announced this program, that
sure,
people would still owe the full sums later.
Sure. And Wayne County has said that it's committed to working out property tax payment plans. I wanted to ask both of you, when you think about the people that you've met and interviewed over the years who are dealing with this, what does it mean to ask people who have bottomed out within the system to reconnect with that same system? Kat, what comes to mind about this?
Well, for me, what's really striking about this is I keep thinking back to 2018 when I had a sit down interview with Gary Brown, the director of the water department. And I asked him, you know, have you heard what activists are saying, that there are people living in our community who have not had water for over a year, and in some cases longer than that? At the time, I was told, they said, well, there's a lot of different reasons for why this might be happening. I asked for an exact number. They never responded. But now they have actually said that there are people living without water for extended periods of time. And so for me, when I think about all of the people that I've talked to on the ground, when I think about the families and the mothers who are raising their children without water service, I'm sure a lot of them are happy to hear this. But again, as of, I think, yesterday, only a little over 70 or so lines have been reconnected. And we're in the middle of a crisis. So a lot of people are saying, okay, we need to kick this into overdrive. We have thousands of occupied homes that are without service. How are we going to get them back in service in a quick manner. I think that's what's at the top of people's minds. And even beyond this virus, as Nancy said, what's next?
Sure.
Will I still have to pay these outstanding bills?
Sure. We should mention Consumers Energy and DTE have also both announced that they're going to suspend cutting power for delinquent bills. This is really starting to sweep most, if not all, aspects of infrastructure. Who decides when this stuff becomes an emergency? I mean, the coronavirus, no doubt, is sort of an unparalleled public health situation. But Nancy, what do you think?
I think one of the things, particularly on the foreclosure side, that has been very problematic is that there aren't a lot of rules about who decides what when. And I think that that's one of the things that is a great question. You said, who decides? And who decides when the emergency is over? And in the meantime, one of the things that we are asking people to do to take advantage of, you know, a new payment plan that the city and county are offering that will cap the amount of back taxes that homeowners owe if they're eligible for the poverty exemption, is to work with this system that has been very difficult to navigate.
And come up with some kind of fresh start, if that's even possible.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the big things in Detroit is that the city offers a full exemption on property tax to folks who are living in poverty. But you have to apply for it. And to apply for it, you have to know that it exists. And the city has done not a very good job of communicating that this exists to the people who qualify for it. A community survey last year reached out to 24,000 homeowners who were tax delinquent and found that 75% of them would be eligible for this exemption, but they didn't know about it, so they can't apply. And that's sort of the first step into getting into this new payment plan the city is offering, is getting that exemption. So folks really have to know that that is a thing so that they can apply for it and get that exemption. If you're listening to this and that's you, you can apply for this. You can Google Detroit Poverty Exemption and get the application online.
The governor has an awful lot of power right now. A lot of that has been focused on the public health situation and the economic situation. Kat, could you foresee Governor Whitmer exercising her authority to try to do something that might help a number of different Michigan communities that have sort of fallen into a spiral, at least with the foreclosure and taxation issue?
I think at this point, any and everything is on the table. I don't, of course, want to speculate, but I think what we have seen across the country is a lot of governors stepping up and really leading their states, their communities, and implementing a lot of these, you know, changes that you've seen in Michigan, in Ohio, and the list goes on, New York. I think that we are in a very rare time. And again, it goes back to the point I made earlier that a lot of activists are hoping to use this moment to find a way to actually push for some systemic change in their communities. And one thing I wanted to point out, going back to the water shutoffs, is what's curious to me is just a couple years ago, or really just even a month ago, we had officials saying, you know, we cannot put any sort of income-based payment plan into place. It's a violation of the Headley Amendment. That's what officials have been saying. But now we see that we can indeed do something to help people out. So the question that I have and many others have is, what happens next?
To follow on to what Kat was saying, I think one thing worth considering is that when folks say, I can't do this because it would, I'm required by law to have the tax foreclosure auction. We can't offer tiered water service rates for people in poverty because it violates the Headley Amendment, or the Bolt ruling. If these things are true, and then the only, you know, sort of rationale for why we're doing this now is that the folks up the food chain are going to overlook it because we're in a crisis, that doesn't answer the question. The question is then, one step up the food chain, why are we not doing this? Why is this not enough of a crisis to merit action when there's not an epidemic or a pandemic? So I think what we're really understanding, though, is that we just can't do it because it's not the law is going to be an insufficient excuse going forward.
Nancy Kaffer is a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. We've also been speaking with Kat Stafford. You can read her writing about race and ethnicity with the Associated Press. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us. I'm sure we'll be talking more about this year.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So is this true? Does it really take a global pandemic for leaders to think seriously about those most in need? Patrick Cooney is the assistant director for the Detroit Partnership on Economic Mobility. That's part of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. And he spent his career researching economic and education policy as it affects people living on low incomes. Patrick Cooney, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
We've just heard the suggestion there's something seriously wrong if we cannot, as a society, provide something as basic as running water to people. Is that the way you'd frame what's been happening?
I think that the points that have been raised by, I think, a lot of folks in the community saying that, you know, it sort of takes this level of crisis in order to implement these measures that place, you know, a moratorium and a water shutoffs, for example. The points are exactly right. I think the deeper point, though, is think about how we use the moratorium, which, you know, in this sense is sort of a pause and obviously not a long-term solution, but as a way to plan for the future. With water shutoffs in particular, how do we use this as an opportunity to think through how we structure sustainable rate plans or different water assistance programs to make sure folks never get cut off from water? I think what we're seeing now is a sort of an outpouring of collective will to make these changes happen in a time of emergency. We need to recognize as well that every time in a sort of normal state of affairs that someone's water gets shut off, it obviously is a tragedy. And so we need to be thinking through, how do we manage these programs when things get back to quote unquote normal?
What would it look like to initiate some kind of transformation that might affect the foreclosure crisis in the city?
Poverty Solutions has sponsored a fair amount of research on the topic. The city and the county have made tremendous strides in implementing the PAYS program, for example, and have been working incredibly hard to reduce the overall number of foreclosures in the city, particularly owner-occupied foreclosures. But I think, again, this is sort of an opportunity for us while we have this moratorium where we don't have to spend this next year fighting tooth and nail to make sure that we can keep people in their homes because of this moratorium. You know, we need to use this as an opportunity to plan for the future. How do we get more Detroiters enrolled in the PAYS program, which, again, will dramatically reduce the overall delinquent tax burden for a lot of Detroit households and will eliminate interest rates. So how do we get more people involved in that program to reduce the overall delinquent burden so that in years forward, we don't have to have sort of a crisis mode every year, but can sustainably plan to make sure we can make foreclosure a rare thing rather than a regular thing.
Patrick, the fiscal issues that drove policies at Detroit's Water Department and within taxes and assessment and foreclosures did not really just spring out of nowhere. Is it going to be possible to extricate the fiscal concerns that led the city to take a hard line on these issues from the policy that probably everybody would like to see?
We need to do, speaking from our side, a lot more research into potential solutions. We keep hearing about, you know, what could a potential alternative rate structures be so that we can get Detroit, speaking about water in particular, on a more progressive rate structure so that low-income and middle-income homeowners aren't paying such high bills, they can have sustainable bills. How would that work in Detroit? We haven't really done much on that yet, so we have to look into more. You know, one thing that we have looked into is we partner with a group at University of Michigan called the Detroit Metro Area Community Study, DMACS, and they did some polling of Detroiters on water shutoffs and their experiences with water shutoffs. One thing that they found was that water shutoffs were actually far more prevalent, not in the lowest income households, but in sort of just those a little bit above that lowest income level, because the lowest income households could qualify for water assistance programs. So, you know, you look at that and you say, well, there is a potential fix, again, if we have the collective will to expand water assistance programs to a higher income threshold. Mm-hmm. And so there are solutions like that. It's just going to be taking, I think, a lot more research to get down to the details of what can be done, again, to make sure that we make these things in normal times, make these things rare occurrences rather than normalized occurrences.
I have a question for you about education. Michigan schools are racing to go online, and it seems evident that this period in education is going to look very, very different for places like Bloomfield Hills and Ann Arbor than it will in Flint in Detroit. Do you think it's possible to extricate our plan for education from our plan for social services? I mean, how can learning happen without support for families in need who now have kids at home for weeks?
You hit the nail on the head. I think that throughout the online education space, be it in K-12 or in higher education, I think we've seen it sort of doesn't deliver equal quality to everyone. I think it depends on your household resources. It depends on one's motivation to pursue online education on their own. So if we're going to shift to more online modes, it's going to take deep consideration on what other supports are needed for those that, you know, may not have the household resources, for those that simply don't have a computer in the house or are not connected to the internet. You know, obviously we know that Detroit has kind of consistently been ranked as one of the least connected cities in the country. We actually sponsor a fellow who works at the city, Joshua Edmonds, who's actually working on digital inclusion issues. So these issues are sort of essential. But again, we hope this sort of current situation doesn't last for that long. But while it is going on, I think that, you know, we can't just say, yeah, we're going to flip everything online. We need to think about all of the other kind of inequities that exist between households.
What would it mean to fund such things? I mean, I'm thinking about Michigan's tax structure right now, and I'm trying to think if transformational change can happen in a state that was, before all this, involved in a serious argument over funding for road fixes. I mean, is there a way to channel all the private sector philanthropy that's going on right now into what may happen in the future?
I mean, it's a good question. I don't know that I know the answer to it. I think one thing that's been kind of consistently borne out, you know, particularly in the education space, is this need for the per pupil spending to be adjusted based on low income status and the share of low income students at the school building. So, you know, commonly measured by the share of free and reduced lunch students. So, you know, that is one issue that I think has consistently been found, that those students need additional per pupil state funding. It's happened in other states. Michigan has commissioned studies to look at the issue and have consistently found that, yes, this is needed in order to properly serve these students. And so I think it's a sure thing. It definitely does need to happen. to make some progress, you know, the overall equity gaps we see.
Patrick Cooney is with the Detroit Partnership on Economic Nobility, which is part of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan is dangerously short of COVID-19 test kits, and the tests themselves present all kinds of logistical problems for clinics and hospitals. As medical teams try to test those deemed most in need, a new testing option is opening up at drive-thrus. In this utterly unique moment in American public health, doctors are hoping that drive-through testing for the new coronavirus might address several problems at once. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has been looking into this and joins me now. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, April.
So an awful lot of people have been hoping that an option like this might be offered widely. Can you tell us where they're being performed right now?
Well, so far, there are four hospital systems that we're aware of performing these curbside tests. There's Beaumont in Metro Detroit, and they have eight hospitals where they're doing testing. There's Spectrum in West Michigan, who has two sites running so far. Henry Ford Allegiance in Jackson, although last we checked with them, they had actually run out of tests. And now the University of Michigan, Michigan Medicine, is testing at three of their ambulatory care sites. We know that there are likely more in the works, and there are additional hospitals that are doing curbside assessments for COVID-19, but not the actual testing.
Sarah, why were medical professionals interested in doing drive-through testing? I mean, a lot of us have never even seen anything like this in the medical system before.
Well, as I'm sure we all know right now, COVID-19 is highly contagious. So obviously, if people are infected and don't need immediate medical help, they want to keep them from coming inside a hospital or a doctor's office as much as possible to keep from infecting others. Also, in theory at least, drive-thrus testing could be done pretty quickly, but we'll explore that more in just a couple of minutes.
Well, what makes a person who might have symptoms consistent with coronavirus actually a candidate to get a drive-thru test?
That criteria actually varies from hospital to hospital, and there are also a lot of subjective clinical decisions being made on the front lines right now. Let's talk about Beaumont for a minute. They're talking about testing the highest risk individuals, and James Ziada is the chief of emergency medicine at Beaumont Royal Oak, and here's how he describes what that means.
Our elderly patient population, patients with immunocompromised conditions, hypertension, coronary disease, or significantly symptomatic.
Sarah, you talked with a couple of folks who went to Beaumont for drive-through tests. Can you tell us what they shared with you about how this goes?
Sure thing. So the first was Hal Noonan, and he's 63 years old. And he says his symptoms started with a little sniffle in early March and then progressed to a cough and shortness of breath.
A feeling that my lungs aren't right. It's a feeling I've never had before. I'm 63 years old.
He never really had much of a fever, but his doctor's office told him to go get tested. So he went to Beaumont and Royal Oak, and after waiting for more than 6 hours, he did get tested with a nasal swab test, which is how they perform these.
During the course of this, they explain, this will be tested for the flu and for the coronavirus if the flu test is negative.
So his flu test did come back negative, and he's still waiting on the COVID-19 results, and he should know that by the end of this week.
All right, that's pretty straightforward. What about the other person you talked to?
All right, her name is Tina Louise, and she's 43 years old. And she has a pretty long story, but basically she's been sick since late February. She did test positive for strep, but she took the round of antibiotics for that and didn't feel any better. And her symptoms include a cough, fever, chest pain, and shortness of breath. So she went to Beaumont Royal Oak to do the drive-through test, and she passed through the initial assessment, and they put her in line. And then she waited for 2 hours, but when she got to the next checkpoint there, a nurse told her,
"Well, I'm really sorry, but, you know, you don't qualify for testing."
So then she went home, and the next day she had a telemedicine appointment, and her doctor told her to go get tested and said, "You know, I've heard Beaumont has this drive-through testing now."
And I kind of laughed a little and was like, "Well, I did that already, and I got turned away."
So the day after that, she called the Beaumont hotline again, and the nurse told her not to come in and was honest with her and said the reality of this is that they're rationing tests right now.
So there may be drive-through testing happening, but it's not a test-on-demand situation.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's we just kind of have to guess why Hal got tested and Tina did not. It could be their difference in age. Also, the hospitals are admitting that their test criteria is somewhat fluid, so they're making different decisions. Different hospitals have different criteria. And a lot of people on the front lines are just making a lot of subjective clinical decisions here. So the bottom line is you could be sent to a drive-through but still not get a test. But the best thing to do is to call the hospital hotlines that these hospitals have set up to check for their criteria and get an assessment before you do that. And we'll put all this information up at michiganradio.org so people can check it out.
2 hours in line and some people are still not getting tested. I mean, I just wonder what the mood has got to be like at these drive-through testing sites. Did the folks that you talked to tell you anything about that?
Yeah, I guess Tina Louise told me that she was FaceTiming with her friend the whole time, so that helped her a lot. You know, she obviously had some pretty significant anxiety about this, so that helped her get through that. Hal Noonan, who waited in line for 6 hours, said, you know, it was just, you just kind of have to wait it out and sit there. And he was making constant Facebook posts about the whole thing. So I think social media and things like FaceTime are helping people out.
Sarah, thanks for the report. We really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Over the past few days, Michigan's executive branch has been a blur of activity. Things are starting to happen in the legislative branch as well, as lawmakers in Lansing come to terms with the full reality of the new coronavirus. Michigan's legislature has approved $125 million in spending for COVID relief. Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks for being here, Rick.
Glad to be back.
So what happened? Did the legislature get its quorum? What happened yesterday?
Oh, my God. Now, first of all, I have to acknowledge that I was socially distanced that, like a lot of political reporters, was following it online, although there were a small group of reporters who took one for the team and were on site. I mean, they didn't even have an entire contingent of people there. Even legislators were saying, we're not going to participate in this. But this is one of those things. It went on and on and on and on. There was even this happens a lot during lame duck when the legislature is meeting very, very late and people start getting loopy, is legislators will actually gather in the rotunda of the Capitol and one of them will play the piano while they sing Christmas carols and pop songs.
Oh,
and so that's actually how it got so loopy. So
So does the Michigan legislature have like a disaster plan for how everybody gets together to vote on very important things when you're not supposed to be together?
Apparently, the disaster plan is to get together and vote on very important things when you're not supposed to be together.
I see.
I mean, in fairness, this is unprecedented that everyone in public agencies, at healthcare centers and hospitals, and the legislature and the governor's office are trying to figure out how to manage this situation when things are turning on a dime constantly. And so there were requests, ideas that the Republicans who are in charge in the legislature are very influenced by what they're hearing from the president and the White House, that because this matters with their constituents back home. And so when the president started talking like this is a serious matter right now, we started to see a sea change in the rhetoric from the legislature that this needs to be taken seriously right now. And so we saw accommodations on some things, primarily regarding funding for efforts to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus.
So tell us about this package that was passed yesterday. What does it involve?
Well, it primarily involves, like I said, money to deal with getting money to hospitals and clinics, to free up money to help pay for tests when the federal government gets them rolling, things like that. There's also, I think, a larger implication for this going forward. And by larger, I don't mean more significant, but longer lasting in how this has been handled.
Right. Where's the money coming from? Last time I checked, the general fund was not so flush that, several million was that easy to come by.
This money does mostly come out of the general fund that, the money that comes from income taxes and other taxes. It's $125 million in a stopgap budget bill to put more money into things like monitoring the spread of the virus, ways to control the spread of the virus, hospitals, medical sides. I mean, some of the money, I think it's $35 million, is just set aside for what we're going to need, but we don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair at a time like this. Mm-hmm. Rick, there are so many things that we could talk about right now in terms of public health, in terms of Michigan's economy, but I've got to ask about schools. Mm-hmm. After a 10-hour legislative session, was there discussion about whether the legislature will address the amount of time that Michigan's kids are going to be out of school?
Well, that's why we don't have a supplemental spending plan on schools, because we don't know how long kids are going to be out of school. Look, as a practical matter, it's starting to look like summer break may have already begun
March. I cannot, as a parent, even hear that. Mm-hmm. Wow.
But, we don't know when kids are going to go back to school. And over the long term, this opens up a whole lot of other questions that, even once we're past addressing the coronavirus, some of the standards that are being adopted right now because of this emergency are going to be debated over whether or not maybe they should become permanent. That are we going to see a stronger case being made, for example, for online charter schools? Because right now we have a lot of schools that are trying to deal with this in some respects by moving into online classes. Now, I don't think there's any education expert, any reputable education expert, who would say that online classes are better than kids being at school. But nevertheless, we're already seeing discussions about that starting to bubble up.
Yeah.
What does this mean for how the school year should be spread out? What does this mean in terms of all the different kinds of accreditation for various professionals? That we're going to see the implications of this crisis playing out in policymaking and policymaking debates for possibly, probably years to come.
Another top line concern for educators is what all this might mean for the state's mandates for testing, mm-hmm. for third grade reading proficiency. What were you hearing?
Oh, that there is a call right now, and there is certainly a logic behind it, that we need to amend or maybe even cancel testing, because one of the things that testing is supposed to do is to measure a school's performance. Well, how do you measure a school's performance this year compared to last year and the year before and the year before that?
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a non-starter. Rick, the legislative leadership was a little quiet those first few days when Michigan's coronavirus cases were just emerging. Are you sensing much agreement right now, either in one part or the other or both, that Governor Whitmer is doing the right things and that at least the situation is getting the attention it needs?
Well, based on the rhetoric, and that's not necessarily the same as what we're seeing, behind closed doors, is that there does seem to be a sense of among the leaders that we all need to pull together and come up with a commonly agreed to plan to move ahead, at least in the short term. But don't forget, too, that Governor Whitmer has now become a sought-after Democratic voice on the congressional and White House response to the coronavirus, which means that she's also become reciprocally a target for Republicans on that particular rhetoric. And any time that starts to happen, then that complicates any kind of efforts of this sort.
So I don't mean to be flip, but I guess this means we won't be talking about that road fix anytime soon.
Well, I don't know about that road fix, but one of the emergency measures that's being taken is lifting weight restrictions on trucks so that they can get emergency medical supplies to the places that they need faster, more of it faster. And as we know, truck weights are one of the most significant factors in tearing up the roads. And so not only are we not talking about road funding right now, I hear that was once an issue, but we are actually taking actions that are going to exacerbate that particular problem.
Rick Pluta is the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capital Bureau Chief. Rick, on that note, thank you.
Always a pleasure, April.
A couple things happened today that hit very close to home here in Michigan. First off, the United States border with our northern neighbor, Canada, is closing for the time being. Here's Vice President Mike Pence at a press conference earlier today.
Now, the president, as you all are aware, also announced today that by mutual consent, the northern border to Canada will be closed to non-essential travel. This does not include essential travel or the transit of goods.
All non-essential travel between the U.S. and Canada is stopping for the time being. The Canadian government says that healthy people who have to cross the border to work will still be allowed to cross. But what does that mean for someone like a Detroit Red Wings color commentator?
As a broadcaster for the NHL, he is on hiatus, indefinitely.
That's Ashley Woods. She's a journalist in Detroit at the head of news site Detour. Her father is Paul Woods, former hockey player and now sports broadcaster. Yesterday, he heard the border might be closing, and he headed for Canada to be with his elderly mother.
We realized that he had to go, so he headed for the border to my grandma's house outside Grand Bend. And, the border will be shut down any minute now, so that's that.
Ashley says she's pretty happy that her dad will be with her grandma, and she trusts the Canadian healthcare system. But she's not sure when she's going to see her father again.
But, I have a newborn son, and it's really hard to think about the fact that my dad's only seen him a couple times, and I don't know when he's going to see him again. And were something to happen, I'm not sure if we'd be able to get back or vice versa. And that is a sobering thought. Hopefully that's the worst case scenario, but it's hard not to think about it.
Ashley says that her dad, as a citizen of the British Commonwealth, is a big fan of Winston Churchill, and he turns to Churchill in moments like this.
And he said this to me. I just talked to him on the phone, and he said, remember, Ashley, and he quoted the line from Churchill's, greatest speech, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender. And that's what I just keep thinking, is that this is a really hard moment, but we will never surrender.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we're going to explore in greater detail the implications of another big story in Michigan today. The big three auto companies announced they're suspending operations at their manufacturing plants. We hope you can join us as we share more about that tomorrow. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Thursday.